this time on Weather Brains.
We still think September will be an active month.
We check in with Colorado State University's Dr. William Gray to get his latest prediction for the remaining Atlantic hurricane season. James Spann shares his thoughts on where developing storms might go.
I just think the pattern is going to favor them either recurving into the open Atlantic or threatening the East Coast.
Also this time, a Weather Brains extra.
So many people ask us, why are y'all doing this? And we said, you're a neighbor. We would hope you'd do the same for us if something like this happened to us.
1 year after Katrina, we look back at Vestavia dentist Keith Miller's mission of love to help victims of the storm. That and more coming up. Welcome to Weather Brains, the weather program that is all about weather, put together by a bunch of weather geeks like myself, David Black, with the Weather Company out of Birmingham, Alabama, and hello as well to fellow weather geek, James Spann, lead meteorologist, ABC 3340, Birmingham. How are you, sir? What's up?
David, I'm just doing great. Looking at computer model output, and that's got to qualify me as a geek.
Well, we'll talk more about that momentarily. A hello as well to fellow geek J.B. Elliott of the Weather Company, the legend of Birmingham weather. How are you, Mr. Elliott?
I'm not a legend, but I'm feeling good. I feel good. Right. It's good to be with you guys. I feel honored to be with you guys.
I think people would take issue with that. They consider you a legend.
No, I'm a dum-dum.
We're thrilled to have you here. Well, listen, guys, we're in the middle of tropical time here, and I just thought we'd maybe start off and kind of get an update on what's happening in the tropics in the Atlantic right now.
Dr. Spann is on.
The buck has been passed.
I know that. I sure get the idea that the bulk of these long-track Cape Verde-type systems this year, David, are going to be more of an Atlantic threat. And that's not saying they're all going to be Atlantic storms, but it sure looks like that pattern is setting up. I think Ernesto was trying to telegraph a message to us that that will be the preferred track for a lot of these things over in the Atlantic. As we do this podcast, we've got the sixth tropical depression of the season out there, and that looking at the new model data that's trickling in, that's beginning to look like a recurving storm. And if anybody on the East Coast is threatened, I think it might be Nova Scotia and the Canadian Maritimes up there. So I don't think that'll be a Gulf storm. And you just have to wonder. And we have a series of waves lined up. They all look good. Just now the wave train is looking active. But you just have to think that this might be the Atlantic coast season. I really think the only way we'll get a big Gulf threat this year, David, is maybe if something develops down there around the northern tip of Yucatan and then comes right at us from the south. I think the homegrown system is going to be the biggest threat for the Gulf, where those long-track systems that come all the way across the Atlantic, I just think the pattern is going to favor them either recurving into the open Atlantic or threatening the East Coast. Not that we want to, wish these on somebody, but it sure looks like it's setting up that way for this year.
But then I suppose, James, if we did have a system form in the more southern reaches of the Caribbean, we might be talking a Gulf storm, possibly?
Oh, yeah. It's possible. It's certainly possible, but I just think that the area to watch, if you're in Pensacola or Panama City or New Orleans, is the Bay of Campeche and that Yucatan Strait area, the channel there between Yucatan and Cuba. Stuff down there could be a problem, but all of this Hurricane Alley stuff just looks like Atlantic storms. But we'll
James,
see.
How are the hurricane models looking at the potential Florence? I haven't even looked in the last several hours.
JB, the new OZ data is in, and again, for those of you that don't know, we tape this typically on a Monday night, so this is Labor Day night, and the evidence of recurving is getting stronger and stronger. The models are bending it north out there toward 120 hours this weekend, and one model is actually recurving it northeast. The others just have it bending north, and that would seem to lessen the threat to the United States. But there's a school of thought that there might be a big high up there that'll block the northward motion, which might make for some nervous forecasters in New York City and Boston and places like that.
But, might push it further back west.
Yeah, it's not out of the question. But the GFS, the 12Z run, I've not seen the 18Z run, but the 12Z run took it up close to Nova Scotia and kept it well east of the United States coast. Not the GFS is perfect, but we'll see.
So if somebody wanted to sneak in a post-Labor Day trip to the Gulf Coast, it's pretty wide open, easy pickings as far as any tropical threats right now.
Yeah, I think so. If you're trying to go down to Destin or wherever for the next several days, I think you'll be fine. In fact, we watched our Skycam. You know, we got this camera on top of a 12-story building in Gulf Shores, which is just east of the public beach, right there at that T intersection. And we had a ball watching kids down there on surfboards and fooling around today. It was great fun watching people enjoy this. You know, for many people, it's the last weekend of summer. Summer's mm-hmm. last gasp out there. But a lot of folks down there having fun today.
I've had a couple of occasions I have to tell you about, James, and you probably had these too. I've popped up that webcam for Gulf Shores, and just I would somehow pick the magical time to see this wide open expanse of beach and hardly anybody on it, even earlier in the weekend, and I thought, need to be there.
Yeah, even Friday afternoon, David, we had that wide shot looking back toward the old public pier and the Alabama State Park. It wasn't a soul down there.
Man.
And I will say this. I mean, this probably sounds like a free plug for the Gulf Coast tourism industry, but I think fall is the greatest time to go.
Well, yeah, and the rates drop a little bit, too.
Yeah, it's cheap. You can stay very inexpensively. It's not crowded. You can still have delightfully warm days and those cool, crisp nights. I absolutely love fall. In fact, during Ivan, Ivan was in September. We went down there a month later and did a special in October. And I remember sitting on the beach before the show. It was a Saturday night show. I was the only human being as far as the eye could see. And it was a nice breeze coming out of the north. It was so nice. So one of these years, I need to do a week fall getaway down there.
So what would be the possibility of the Weather Brains crew doing a show from the Span 5,000-foot square foot condo down there? Could we maybe head down there and do that?
I've got a cardboard box that we can use, a big refrigerator box. But
you up for it, JB?
Oh, yeah.
Take some Pop-Tarts, too.
Yeah. I think we ought to do a show from the back deck of the Pink Pony and let JB, I think that JB would be a babe magnet down there.
So Weather Brains on the road.
That's it.
All right. Well, no hurricanes to threaten, so we could have a lot of fun. If you were to judge the 2006 Atlantic hurricane season by what happened during August, well, you might be inclined to call predictions of an active season a bust. But you may be premature, according to Dr. William Gray of Colorado State University. Gray expects September to be a busy month in the tropics, even though, as he tells Weather Brains, August tropical activity was less than spectacular.
We haven't had a very active August. I think we haven't had a major storm. We only had one hurricane, Ernesto, and it didn't last very long because it went over land. And I think that was it. It might have become a major storm if it had gone further south or further north. But overall, the August was not a very active year. And as we look back and we reconstruct it, we think in the tropical Atlantic, the middle troposphere was drier than normal, and we had considerable amounts of dust coming off West Africa. We didn't expect that as much. Also, in the eastern equatorial Pacific, the water temperatures have been warming a little faster than we had thought. So overall, I think those two major factors combined to make August less active than we had previously thought, and those factors are still there somewhat, so we've brought our forecast down further from what it was. We had been forecasting 15 named storms, 7 hurricanes, and 3 major ones for this year. Now we've brought that down further to 13 named storms, 5 hurricanes, and 2 major ones.
Dr. Gray, I hear a lot of forecasts say it could continue to be slow, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's a big flare-up with a multitude.
Well, that's right, sure. That's typically the way things go. You go with these quiet periods, and then you have these active periods. Yes, tropical storms tend to cluster in periods of 10 to 12 days or so. Yeah, so we still think September will be an active month, not perhaps a little bit above average, but October won't. As the El Nino comes on, we think the October won't be quite as active as the average month. But we feel We've still got a good 30 days left in September, and we think there's a good possibility of a lot of storms there. We're actually forecasting five named storms, three hurricanes and two major ones for this month coming up of September.
You told me earlier in the year when we talked, if I remember correctly, you thought we stood a better chance of having more Atlantic coast storms.
That's where, yeah, that is right. The signals were just better. We've had to have this very strong thermohaline circulation, and that continues to be there. So we still think that the East Coast is a major area we should look for storms.
NASA currently has a research team looking into the Cape Verde Islands area.
Yeah, right.
Looking at the Saharan dust layer. Do you feel as if that's a real promise, but potential for us to learn more about hurricane forecasting?
Well, it'll certainly add to our knowledge, yeah, in that we did have a lot of dust outbreaks so far this year. And, you know, the Africa thing has been a bit of a mystery to us. It worked so well. I had a graduate student, Chris Lancey, very talented fellow, who did a PhD thesis on the West Africa rain, and it seemed to work very well. But it hadn't worked very well since the middle 90s. And we don't exactly know why, so I think this NASA program and things, maybe they could shed a little more light on it.
So what's your message to people who are looking at the current hurricane season, that it's been a little slower than first forecast, people who are saying, well, there was nothing to it? Is that a bit premature?
No, yes. We're only a third away from the season. We have the major month coming in front of us. September has nearly half the activity of the average season. So we got most of the season coming for us. The next 30 days will determine just how active this season's going to be, and we're forecasting a pretty active September. So, no, just because August hasn't had that much doesn't mean that we won't see a lot of storms in September here.
Thank you very much for working me
in
talking.
Oh, yeah. Okay, sure. We're glad to talk with you.
After 22 years of making these forecasts, the 76-year-old Dr. Gray says he's stepping back and will have Phil Klotzbach assume the primary responsibility for the project's seasonal, monthly, and landfall probability forecasts. Klotzbach has been a member of Gray's research project for the last 5 years, so we may be hearing and perhaps talking with him at some point, we hope. Dr. Gray says he plans to spend more of his efforts, quote, on the global warming issue and in synthesizing my project's many years of hurricane and typhoon studies, end quote. He says he will remain closely involved in the issuing of these forecasts for the next few years.
I hope he'll write a book when it's all over.
You know, that would be a fantastic idea. I hope
spending his whole career.
He's got a lot of interesting stories to tell. A lot of knowledge in that gentleman.
This guy can't retire. What's
yeah,
up with that?
That makes me a little... But he's got some good people around him. And he deserves some time off. I do think when you're 76 and you've been doing that for over two decades, you probably deserve to step back. And I can appreciate that. But he's a jewel.
I wonder how much all this pressure, this global warming thing, has impacted that decision. He's probably tired of it, you know, of all these personal attacks and insanity that he deals with. But, you know, I look back on these tropical experts, and a lot of people claim to be tropical experts, and they're really not. But you look at Dr. Gray, and I think his ideas are just excellent. And the other guy that I miss is John Hope. I don't know if you guys remember him or not.
Yep.
You know, John worked for the National Hurricane Center for many years, and in his later career, he worked for the Weather Channel. And let me tell you what, that guy knew what he was talking about.
Yeah.
And they are, you cannot beat experience, and both will be, John Hope has been missed, and Dr. Gray will be missed when he retires, too.
John Hope's been gone about 5 years, isn't he? Hasn't he?
I think so. And, you know, I don't watch the Weather Channel much, and not that I'm negative against the thing, but whenever he would come on there, we'd always turn it up.
Yeah, exactly. When you saw him, you stopped what you were doing and listened. He was just one of those people.
Absolutely.
Well, 1 year ago this week, we were watching in horror as unprecedented human suffering unfolded along the Gulf Coast following Hurricane Katrina. Most of the storm damage we first saw came out of New Orleans, but it was South Mississippi that, although devastated, missed much of the nation's attention. Knowing that the suffering there must be horrible, Vestavia Dentist and private pilot Keith Miller decided to do something about it. Miller flew his single-engine Piper Lance from Birmingham to South Mississippi three times, carrying donated supplies to storm victims. Three fellow pilots joined Miller in a relief effort one of his friends called a mission of love. In a Weather Brains Extra for you this time, Keith Miller shares his Katrina experience with us. It's a compelling story that's part of a chilling indictment of our government's response to Katrina. Keith, 1 year ago, all the attention was focused on New Orleans. So what caused South Mississippi to be on your radar?
Well, that very reason right there, just watching all the local news coverage and the national news coverage on CNN and whatnot, everything was focused on New Orleans. And, you know, watching the Weather Channel and all that, the eastern side of the eyewall went through southern Mississippi. And so it was like those guys were just down there to fend for themselves, while New Orleans, being such a major city, was the primary focus on everyone's attention.
So it was just watching coverage on the news that mainly made you realize that there was a whole area being overlooked?
That was it. Through flying, there's three other friends of mine that have the same type plane that I do. And we're all good flying buddies, and they're all a little older than I am. They have flown past relief missions before. When Hurricane Andrew went through Miami, they were some of the first ones down there, bringing medical supplies and food and water. And so that also played influence into my idea. You know, why not organize something and get some supplies donated in and take it down there and try to help some of the people out. The first time we went down was on a Friday, the Friday after the storm. Bob Eccles and I had gotten a hangar secured out at Birmingham Airport, and we started getting a lot of our supplies shipped in there for storage.
Did you know exactly where you wanted to go to when you went down there?
No. Initially, we set course for Gulfport, Biloxi. And FAA was kind of hindering all the civil relief efforts. You know, after 9/11, they created what's called a temporary flight restricted zone, also known as a TFR zone. And that's basically is a no-fly zone for civilian pilots. So only military can go in there. And after the hurricane went through, they put in kind of a blanket TFR zone going from the Alabama-Mississippi border all the way over to west of New Orleans. And so the procedure was you had to call the FAA recovery desk, and we'd actually started calling Wednesday after the storm, trying to find out, you know, what special clearance we needed to do to get access to get in there. We could never get through, so that Friday, it was mid-morning, probably around 9:30, and we'd loaded up the plane and everything. Bob said, I'm going to try the FAA desk one more time, and I mean, just stroke of luck, he got in. And I heard him kind of arguing with the person on the phone. The person was telling him that President Bush was down there doing a tour and was at Kessler Air Force Base, and that, you know, there's no way any civilians were going to get in there. And, you know, I heard Bob say, well, so, you know, what are you saying? The FAA is going to prevent a humanitarian effort in a natural disaster. You know, just, I'm sure you'll be glad to hear that on CNN and Fox News and all of that. And he kind of hung up the phone. He said, let's go. So, you know, I called up Birmingham Tower and told him, you know, we're just going to depart VFR and head to the southwest. And so, you know, we kept going on farther south, and Bob, fortunately, is a West Point graduate, so he knows, with his flying experience, he knows a lot about these military ordeals, so he knew what frequencies to dial up to get the plane that was covering the air traffic control that was in flight, just in holding patterns. So all we did was told him, you know, we had a plane full of supplies, and we were requesting to land at Gulfport, Biloxi. And he gave us a transponder code so he could see us on his radar and cleared us to come in.
So you guys went down there basically in defiance of what FAA had told you while you were trying to do a humanitarian mission.
Exactly. Yeah, they told us to sit tight and, you know, that we were not allowed to go in there. So, you know, we just kind of took matters in our own hands and, you know, what's the worst thing they could do when we got down there? They could just say, turn around and go back. And so, you know, we'd turn around and go back or whatever. But fortunately, they let us in. We landed at Gulfport, Biloxi.
And what did you find there?
I mean, it looked like literally a war zone. Just flying in, I mean, that was the eye opener to me.
Were you prepared for what you saw?
Kind of, because when I was a survivor of the F5 tornado that went through Guyon, Alabama, back in April 3rd of 1974, and you know, unfortunately, the tornado went right down our main street. And so, you know, I witnessed all that as a 7-year-old. And I vividly remember all of the destruction from that tornado. And it was down there, it was on that same category, except instead of being like a half-mile swath of destruction or a mile swath of destruction, it was as far as you could see to the right, as far as you could see to the left. When we landed at Gulfport, Biloxi, you know, there were military helicopters just flying left and right. We were the only civilian airplane around there. You know, most of the others at the airport had been either evacuated or, you know, they were in a damaged hangar somewhere. And so we just started walking around trying to find a local that kind of knew what was going on. I found a someone with the National Guard, and they took me to the command center. And honestly, David, I mean, it was incredible how chaotic and disorganized it was down there. We were told to go 3 different places by 3 different people.
So nobody really knew what was going on?
No.
Where was FEMA?
That's a good question. FEMA was nowhere to be found. Everybody was asking us, you know, are y'all from FEMA? And we were like, no, we're not from FEMA. You know, we're private. And, you know, we've got an airplane load of supplies that, you know, we say where it goes.
So you had to find a way to come up with distributing those supplies to people who needed them at that point.
Exactly. You know, they had distribution centers set up in little tents. And, you know, that didn't work too well because the rural people, number one, they had no transportation to get there. And if they walked, you know, they would have to carry all of those supplies back to where they were. And, you know, that just made it impossible for most people to do. So we ran across this young man that he and his wife lived at Biloxi. We told him what we were doing, and so he said, come on, let's go to some local churches and get some more information. So we went to, he was Mormon, and he took us to his church, and I'll tell you what, those people had it together. They made FEMA look like, you know, they were the most unorganized relief effort you could ever imagine. The Mormons had excess supplies of everything you needed there at their church. They brought generators in. They have all these distribution centers set up at strategic locations throughout the United States, and they started moving 18-wheelers in full of supplies ready to come in after the storm. So they were set up fine. And so the pastor told us, he said, the people across the bay at Bay St. Louis and Waveland, from what we've heard, they're hurting really bad over there, so you need to try to get over there. So the young man, I can't remember his name, he offered to take us over there. So he drove us, we left my plane at Gulfport, Biloxi, and we drove over across the bay into Bay St. Louis, and we went to they have an international airport there called Stennis International Airport. We saw where that was and saw that it was open, so we went ahead and drove on into town to try to get, to collect more information. And so the first place we went was to that Walmart parking lot. I think it was on Oprah Winfrey, on one of her televised casts of this. There were people, they had just made makeshift tents, in water, out of whatever they could for their housing there. And what we didn't know until we got back that next Sunday was while we were there that Friday, there was actually 8 people on the roof of that Walmart that was dead, that they had drowned to death up there. We everybody was needing, just the basic essentials, and everyone was asking us, are y'all from FEMA? And we were like, no, we're private. We have more supplies to bring in.
How did you get the supplies off your airplane to where these people were, though, to give them away?
Well, what we ended up doing, David, we drove back over to Biloxi Airport, flew my plane over to Stennis, and landed there. And basically, we had to take matters in our own hands there and just find someone who was a local, and I just happened to run into the airport manager and told him what we were doing, and he arranged everything for us. He got the plane offloaded with all the supplies. It was getting late that day, and there was a curfew that we had to be out by 7 o'clock, I think it was. And so we left the supplies there at the airport with him, and we told him that we were going to be back on Saturday, the next morning. So the next morning, we carried 2 planes down there. Me and my wife in my plane, David McGiffin and his wife in David's plane. So we left about 8 o'clock, got down there around 9:15, landed at Stennis International Airport at Bay St. Louis. And there again, we had to physically, just grab people and ask them if they knew any way we could get transportation to carry these supplies into the town. We finally ran back into the airport manager. So, there was no way to communicate once we got down there by cell phone. And he arranged for us military Humvees with military police escorting us. They didn't feel comfortable with us going into Waveland and to the Lakeshore area without some type of military protection, because they felt, people were getting desperate at this time, and they may attack us. So our plan of action that time was to hit all the rural back roads south of Waveland. The girl that went with us, she was the daughter of the airport manager, and she was born and raised in Waveland. So she carried us wherever we needed to go. And basically what we did, David, people there at the airport would unload the planes. I've got photos of this. They would unload our planes onto either flatbed trucks or Humvees with trailers. We would just go off the main road and just hit back roads. And really all you would see would be either abandoned houses that were partially standing. All the houses had painted markings on them, and it had numbers on it, and if it was black, that meant there were bodies in the house. If it was red, that means that it was all clear. And there were a couple of houses that had not even been searched out there where we were. And fortunately, we had the National Guard people with us, and we went through a couple of houses just to check and make sure no one was there.
But you guys were handing out supplies directly to some victims.
Yeah, that's how we did it. We just went driveway to driveway, and we would ask people what they needed.
What kind of supplies were you there with? Food, toiletries, what?
Anything you could think of. We had food, water, clothes. We had toys for children. We had medical supplies. We clean underwear, toilet, stuff like that.
Everything you'd take for granted that those people did not have at that
point. Yeah, they lost everything. The people that were down there, every one of them had the same look on their face, just an empty, lost look. Everybody was just in shock.
What's your most vivid memory from all of your work to help these people?
Probably the most moving story that I was told, it was getting towards late in the day. This was on Labor Day Monday that we went down there. We had four planes that left out. And we had a big convoy of Humvees. I mean, we had just tons of supplies. And we passed this one. It was really just a foundation that was on the left. And I was in the lead Humvee, and I radioed back to Bob. I said, "Let's turn around and go back. There were people sitting out there." And so we turned around and went back, and it was a middle-aged mother, her son who was probably 17 or 18, and then her mother who was in her early 80s, and they had lost basically everything. They were sitting there on just like a kitchen chair, had their car parked with the trunk open. We were sitting there just talking to them and telling them what all we had. And the older lady, she disappeared for a minute and went around to the trunk of the car and brought back this white living Bible, like one of those you'd see on a coffee table or something, that size. And she said, "Y'all all see my house up against the trees? You know, it looks like it had just been washed and collapsed up against the back edge of the trees." She said, "You're welcome to walk through it. We've been through it several times. It's nothing but mud, water, everything's ruined in there." But she said, "Y'all don't know me from Adam, but," she said, "I have no reason to lie for you." She said, "This Bible right here was sitting on the table next to the door by the television." And she said, "We found this on the first walk through. It doesn't have a speck of water damage on it." But she said, "You look at our house." And sure enough, I mean, you flip through it, and it looks brand new. But they stayed in their attic through the hurricane. And she had found out that Sunday night that her brother, who was 83, that lived two houses down, which was probably a couple hundred yards, because these were country lots, he was up in his attic and he drowned to death. And so those people had lost everything. They'd lost a family member, they'd lost all of their belongings. They had just the clothes that they had on, which they had been wearing most all week, and just a couple of cans of food. And so, we were able to give them shoes, a couple of changes of clothes each, toiletry items, and, stuff just to make them feel good and let them know that, they're not in this by themselves.
How did that make you feel?
Made me feel great. Made me feel all this was worthwhile,
You knew the trips were worth it.
Exactly. I would do it in a heartbeat again.
You've had a year to look back on what happened and going down there to help these people. What are your impressions now of how government responded to the needs of storm victims in Mississippi?
Looking at it now, and even looking at it then, I was afraid of this. The government, both local and federal, grossly underestimated the strength of a hurricane. And it's like they knew it was there, but they didn't take it that seriously. And then afterwards, after it was happened, the magnitude of the devastation was more than anyone ever expected, and they were caught with their pants down.
I assume that's probably what angered you the most.
Mm-hmm.
What inspired you the most about being down there?
Just the attitude of the people there, just the positive attitude of these people. It's like everything was erased and everyone was there to help each other. There were no racial barriers. There were no socioeconomic barriers. Everyone there did their best to form a union. And one day when we went into downtown Waveland, we parked at the courthouse, I found two deputy sheriffs there standing at the corner. this was on Friday. We were the first outside people they had seen. And one of the deputies, he was mid-40s. He said that he rode out Hurricane Camille when she went through there. And he said he was just past 10 at that time. And he said he rode out this storm, and he said he spent most of the time out in a boat trying to rescue people as the storm surge came in. But he said, comparing the two storms, which everyone's doing, he said, the storm puts Camille to shame. I mean, I remember we saw a house that was sitting in the middle of a railroad track. I mean, just washed in there. And to kind of give you a visualization as to how much water came in, where the exit ramp is off I-10 to go to Waveland. It's one of those that you exit down, so it's an overpass. You could see the water line almost to the top of that overpass.
Goodness.
Where the gulf had come in. And that was a good close to a mile inland.
Does the fact that you were actually there seeing the suffering firsthand make Katrina more real to you than it otherwise might have been?
Oh, most definitely, David. The pictures, all the pictures that were shown were very good pictures. There's just no way they could do them justice unless you were there and saw it with your own eyes. It was just surreal each time. You're just in a state of shock, just awe.
If a major storm like Katrina ever threatens the Gulf Coast again, are you prepared to do this again?
Oh, most definitely. I would do it in a heartbeat. I was really shocked that there were several of us pilot friends that were talking. We were all kind of shocked that there wasn't more of an effort by surrounding states with their private pilots, you know, trying to bring stuff in. So even that weekend, that Friday, Saturday, and Monday that we were down there, we were basically the only civilian planes bringing in supplies. And, you know, we got so many questions, or so many people ask us, you know, why are y'all doing this? And we said, well, and we, you know, you're a neighbor. We would hope you'd do the same for us if something like this happened to us.
And that's really the center core of why you did that, isn't it?
Exactly.
Your friend Bobby Robertson made a post on ABC 3340's weather blog in which he called your work a mission of love when you could have been home with your wife and children. So what made you do this? Why didn't you just sit back and watch like so many people?
I'm just not wired that way. I just like to help people. I mean, that's what I do every day in my practice. I don't do it for notoriety or anything like that. When the cameras were on filming some of this stuff as we were leaving, I had other people do that stuff. I wanted to, it was just something that needed to be done. I mean, at the time, it was just kind of a wild idea saying, hey, you know, we need to do this. I don't know what was pushing me to do it, but, you know, there was something definitely pushing me to do it. I would be on something like this in a heartbeat again with no second thoughts.
FEMA has spent nearly $6 billion helping victims in communities affected by Katrina. But isn't it interesting that in the first few days after the storm, amid all the chaos and confusion, one man who said, I can help, I want to help, was able to do what the most powerful country in the world could not. He directly touched the lives of people who were hurting. Keith Miller's mission of love reminds us that even when facing one of the biggest and most intimidating disasters in our nation's history, one person can still make a difference. At a time when so many of us might say, let someone else handle it, Keith Miller and his friends have shown us what it really means to love thy neighbor. I don't know about you guys, but I think the world would be a better place if we had more people like Keith Miller.
We could use a million of them. That was very dramatic.
Yes, I'm sitting here looking back on the blog, and I posted a note from Keith on September 4th, interestingly enough, that's exactly a year ago. He sent me an email describing what he saw after his first visit, the same thing we just heard there, and I posted it to the blog, and that generated a huge amount of interest, and I think that little note sparked a lot of other folks that wanted to help down there, too. But what a great story.
It did, James. Keith told me that there was a major response to the blog, and he tells me that he asked you to pass the word around at your church, which I believe you did, and that had quite a response.
Yeah, over at Hunter Street, but it's just... That is a feel-good story, and let me tell you, he didn't do that to get on WeatherBrains or to get on some blog. I mean, he had no, the only interest he had in publicity was just getting more people to pitch in and help because it was such a massive deal that he was having to work with down there.
I ran across an interesting statistic out of Katrina that I thought I'd share, too, from FEMA. Since Katrina, more than 99 million cubic yards of debris have been removed in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. That's hard to fathom, that much debris. And I still think a lot of people don't really get the full picture of how widespread that devastation was, and to this day, the hardships that it causes so many people.
But yeah, I would like to go down there at some point. I didn't go down there when it was over last year. I didn't need to get in the way. If I was going down there, I would be helping like Keith, but I didn't have that opportunity, and you know what a wild hurricane season it was. We had no break, but I still think if you go down there today, you'll see a lot of evidence of what happened down there. In fact, posted some photos in the blog here just the other day of that, and I think that's one of those cases, David, where watching it on television or reading about it on some blog or in the newspaper just doesn't do the deal justice. You got to get down there and see it yourself.
Well, coming up next time on Weather Brains, could an Alabama meteorologist's research lead to improved warnings for tornadoes?
We are trying to figure out how these gravity waves could interact with a storm that, say, doesn't already have a tornado and cause it to produce one, or even interact with a tornado that's already there and make it more intense.
Tim Coleman's research into gravity waves. That's next time on Weather Brains.
Hey, Tim Coleman's one of those big brain guys. He's like JB. That's going to be a good show.
Yeah, I was talking to Tim on the phone the other day. I'm anxious to hear his report next week.
Gravity waves are one of the greatest mysteries in the science, and I heard Tim present part of that at a conference here in Birmingham, and it's good stuff, and I can't wait to hear what he has to say this time.
Looking forward to it. A reminder that the opinions you hear expressed here on Weather Brains are strictly those of the speaker, not necessarily those of ABC 3340. If you'd like to contact us, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. Our phone number, if you'd like to leave a voicemail, is 206-339-5482. 206-339-5482. For James Spann and JB Elliott, I'm David Black. We thank you for listening and hope that you can join us again for the next episode of Weather Brains. Weather Brains is copyright 2006, all rights reserved. Guys, thanks very much. Enjoyable program.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Man, you rock.
Thanks, man. Thanks for your help.
Yes, sir. He's network material.
He is. Bye-bye.
Y'all keep out of trouble.